me what you want, tell me what you see, where you wanna go, what you wanna be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice. Wait, hold up, slow down, devil need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them, then after you do, go and talk to him. Wait, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight, take your time today, teach you something right.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends, Twitter, you the trend, name a Bentley Benz, but you moving kind of fast. Keep sweats, you gotta make it last, live every day like it's your last, but don't forget to have a blast.
Welcome, welcome to Time Out. I am your host, Sylvia Crowley Milbury. And I want to start the show off by saying congratulations to the Minnesota Lynx for winning the WNBA championship. I was hoping for a little better final game, but well-deserved for Maya Moore, Simone Augustus. I don't want to start name-dropping, but the whole entire Minnesota Lynx team, I know they work incredibly hard, and they deserve to win a championship. I didn't see a lot of coverage on the championship, and I was a little bit, you know, that just hurt my heart a little bit. But, you know, they had the score on SportsCenter, and, you know, we're not going to get that coverage. But congratulations to them. I just got back home from the Beyond the Bounce retreat. And this was a retreat in Miami held by the Pro Basketball Alumni Association. And it was for current and former NBA and WNBA players. And it was just a conference for life after basketball. So it was called Beyond the Bounce. And we had seminar after seminar just to help players with their transition with life after basketball. They have partnered up with companies who want to partner up with athletes because they feel like, you know, we feel like athletes, we want their determination and their commitment and their go-to mentality and, you know, they're relentless and they'll travel and they'll work hard and the other stuff we could teach you. Plus, they feel like athletes have a lot of branding power from the areas that they're from and the colleges and universities that they went to. So it's actually a very good program, and I was one of the keynote speakers. I had the great opportunity to minister to some of the women of the WNBA and interact with some of the men of the NBA, and I think we need more things like that to help people with their transition. So I was just grateful to just interact with my brothers and sisters who are making that transition because it's not easy. And so I'm just now getting back from that, but just great retreat. I know some of them are on the call, and if you didn't make it this year, please set your calendar as soon as they release the date for next year. It's just a good event to go to, whether or not you're struggling with the transition. I mean, if you're not struggling with the transition, you need to be there to help people who are. And if you're struggling with the transition, you need to be there because they just kind of teach you not to go through it alone. And so I just had an incredible time. So I had to get that off my chest. Tonight, I have a really special show set up for you. I met this, not met, but I bumped into this young man at the Congressional Black Caucus in D.C. a few weeks ago. And you all heard me talk about that and what an incredible time I had there. But my magazine, Monarch Magazine, was one of the sponsors for the entire Congressional Black Caucus. And while I was there, I ran into a guy who was doing a book signing. And lo and behold, who do I see is Derek Anderson. So I went up to him, and I wasn't sure if he would remember me, but we talked, and we have mutual friends, and I asked him to be on the show. He agreed. And then I didn't think he was going to remember that he agreed, but he hit me up on email. We exchanged cards, and he had emailed me before I even got home. And I said, you know what, this is a man of his word. He remembered, and he followed up. And so it is my honor and my pleasure to have on the show Derek Anderson. Derek, are you there?
I am here.
Derek, no problem. Thank you for being here. I've been reading your book all day today, and I've learned some new stuff about you. I'm just blown away by just some of the stuff that you've been through, and you're actually perfect for this show. And your book talks about your traumatic childhood. Can you talk to our listeners about what your life was like growing up as a child in Louisville, Kentucky?
Well, I never like to call it traumatic. I just think it's called living life and making something out of it. You know, we've all had that story where people say, oh, you come from nothing and you made it. And, you know, but people don't tell you how to transform your life into it. And what I did at 11 years old, I was abandoned in an abandoned apartment. And instead of me running to the streets, I went into a grocery store and I carried people's bags. And it was basically the 1980s, mid-80s, and I was, you know, struggling. But I realized that, you know, I want to do it right. So I went to the grocery store, carried people's bags, saved up $3, took all day because they'd give you a nickel or a dime to carry your bag, but I did it all day. And I went to Kentucky Fried Chicken, and I thought about buying a three-piece meal for $2.95. And I thought about it, what if my mother doesn't come back home? So I went back to the grocery store. I grabbed 69-cent bologna, 79-cent loaf of bread, and I went back to my apartment and sat in the hallway and ate bread and bologna and read books all night. She wake up the next day, she's home. I've been taught never to disrespect my parents and my mother. And then she does it again, and then after that, I don't see her for a while. I go through 12 and 13 years old, I'm trying to find a place to stay. I'm living house to house, neighborhoods, and sleeping in abandoned apartments, still going to school. I'm carrying around a plastic bag with a toothbrush and deodorant, and I take wash up when I get to school. Just trying to find a way. I didn't want to be a stingy person of kid, so I've always found a way to try to stay clean. And at age 14, I wound up meeting a high school girlfriend, and she gets pregnant. So here I am, a 14-year-old father. Then the next year, she gets locked up. Now I have a child, custody of a child, and I'm 15 years old. Now it really gets tough. Now I figure I have to get a job. I work at the candy store. I work at a paper route. And my son is staying with neighbors, or his mom's sister would take him sometimes. But I had custody of him at that age and working two jobs, going to school, playing basketball. And then at the age 16, I did the same thing. And then my senior year, she got back in the picture. My Uncle George helped me out, and I graduated with a 3.7 GPA, basketball player, and got a full scholarship. So when I look at some of these people's lives, these kids, they tend to make excuses based upon situations, but every day I woke up, I said, I'm not going to be satisfied by being in this situation, sleeping with candles and no heat, no electricity. I wasn't going to be satisfied with that. So every day I said, I'm not running to the streets. I seen it tear my family up, my friends getting shot and arrested. I said, that's a cowardly way to go. I'm going to earn everything that I get. I did that in basketball. I did that in life. And it lasts longer. So when you looked at it, my life was traumatic, but it was a process that God gives us a face to see. We all got the same free will to make decisions. I chose to make a decision I wanted better. I didn't expect a fortune and fame, but I expected to be out of that poverty place of location and my mind, and I didn't want that. So when I put it in my mind, I was going to be better. It happened to me.
Wow. When did you start playing sports, Derek?
When I got locked out of my apartment.
So at age 11?
I looked at my adversity was awakening to my success. You know, I didn't play, but everyone played sports in the neighborhood, but I wasn't any better than anybody else. Like, I didn't stand out. Like, I wasn't extremely tall. I was already skinny, so I really wasn't the guy he was going to pick up first. You know, I was just a guy who was just going around the neighborhood. You picked up, you played kickball, you played football, you know, with a sock. You know, we did things and put in the project just to hang out. You know, we wasn't worried about everything else. So when I turned 11, I had nowhere to go. I went to the basketball court. I slept outside some nights. With my basketball court, it would be no air in the ball, and I still just shot ball. You know, I even prayed. I used to say this, not a prayer, but it was just like I say, I dribble one for my mother, I dribble two for my father, and I dribble three to see him again. You know, that was my thinking, and I concentrated on that, and I wound up being a great free throw shooter. But it was all out of my adversity that I conquered and make myself a better basketball player.
Now, do you know your father? Did you even know who he was at that time?
Yeah, I knew who he was. I had met him. You know, we lived in Flint, Michigan, and then when we left from up there, we moved back to Louisville, Kentucky, to where my mother's from. And I'd been with him. You know, he'd been around or whatnot. But then after 11, I didn't see him again until I was 33, and I wound up meeting him and hanging out and 10 months later after I met him and I apologized and he wondered why, I told him, I don't know your situation, but I should have found you sooner. And we kind of reconciled. I took him to my birthday. I took him to his birthday dinner. I kind of had a good time, but I only knew him for 10 months, and then he passed away of cancer after 10 months of meeting him. So it was pretty tough to do at that point, but at least I was able to forgive him and move on.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, if you had a chance to forgive him. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to ask you, did you feel like sports was definitely it was an outlet for you, but where your coaches kind of became your mentors and the father figures in your life, did they know at that time that you were kind of sleeping in apartments and doing whatever you could to survive? Were they aware initially of what you were going through?
Yeah, but everyone was struggling. You know, how you tell a kid in a project that his life is any different than anybody else? A lot of them didn't know my situation was that dim, you know, until a little later, but you know, I got to stay with a little high school coach, was a Caucasian man. He wound up knowing that I had a son in my situation. He's like, well, you can stay with me. And I wound up staying under his house for like a few months during the season, and it was totally different. But then I had to go get my son, so I had to go back down to the projects and stay down there. And that's when my Uncle George helped me out. But before then, it was coaches was just, you're used to it. Like I said, everyone was on an even playing field as far as poverty. Of course, mine was a little rougher because I didn't have any parental guidance, but you know, in the projects, all you needed was somebody there to give you an opportunity to help you get out. And in basketball, in high school, in the middle school, coaches, they were there for me. So I think a lot of coaches, some people knew, but again, in poverty, it's very hard to figure out who's worse than the other person.
Right. Now, you ended up getting a full scholarship to play initially at Ohio State. Talk about that period of your life.
Oh, that was the best 2 years of my life. I had my own room, you know, my own bed, I mean. I had lights, I had gas, I had food. I thought I was in, you know, the paradise land because I had been struggling for so long to have any kind of, like, freedom. You know, that freedom, you know, even away from my son, I didn't get to grow up like most people. When I left high, when I was in high school, I worked. I came from basketball practice. I worked from 6 to 8 or 6 to 9 at night and then went back and get my son. And you know, that was what I did for 2 years, and that was a struggle. But when I went to Ohio State, oh, man, it was the greatest years of my – even to this day, I tell people Ohio State was my best 2 years of my entire life, only because I was open, I was free, I could breathe. I had a great friends, you know, my roommates, my college buddies, just friends in the city of Columbus, Ohio, which I'm still connected with. Like, you can't pick that in your life. That was given to you as a gift, and I enjoyed it.
Right. Speaking of Ohio State, we have one of your former teammates on the line. Area code 419. Greg, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Greg, is there anything that you wanted to say to Derek?
D Smooth, what's up, man?
What's up, Chief? My boss.
Not much, man. I was just going to ask you a question because, you know, me and you both did some things this summer. Derek actually came down to Lima, Ohio, and spoke to some kids that I was working with, and we appreciate him for showing up for that. But one of the things I've noticed with working with kids, I would ask you, what advice do you have for kids about attitude and character off the court?
Well, I think the best thing that you do is you build relationships. You know, when you have an attitude outside the court, you can get opportunities that some people can't get. And you and I both know, like, we've seen guys better than us growing up, because their attitude wasn't what it should be or what it wasn't be, people weren't willing to help them. So I think when you tell these kids is you got to think about who's going to give you an opportunity to be a great basketball player and a successful person in life. Because a lot of kids don't see their future. All they see is today. Even when we did it, we probably didn't see our future as much, but we feel like, hey, to get what we needed to do, we need to be cordial and nice to people. And that's when these kids realize these coaches will help them out. They'll send letters to schools or NBA scouts, they'll help you out. But without, you know, with a negative attitude, coaches don't help you anymore. And, you know, some coaches just give up on kids, and that's the problem that we have in the day. A lot of people giving up on each other. So it's up to that kid, to his attitude, to stay positive no matter what happens.
Right. Greg, did you have anything else you want to say before I mute you?
Man, I just want to congratulate you, bro, on everything you're doing with your book, man, and wish you much more success. I appreciate the man that you've become through all the trials and tribulations, and just keep doing what you're doing, man. I know we don't get to speak all the time, but we stay in touch, and I support you, everything you do, man. It's just good to hear from you.
Likewise. I love you, bro. Appreciate you, too, man.
Love you, too. And thanks for having me on, Sylvia.
Oh, no problem. Greg, I appreciate you calling in. If you think of another question or comment that you have, just press 1 and we'll let you back through. Derek, you were at Ohio State at a time where the program was going through some difficult times, I guess I could say. There was a lot of things in the news. I'm from Ohio, so anything that happens at Ohio State, it came through the Steubenville News. And, you know, it was at a time where I think when you were there, Jim Jackson was there, Lawrence Funderburk was there, but those guys graduated and the program took a different shift. You know, so there were some problems there at the time. And so was the team, you know, obviously the team was aware that you had a son. Were they helping you out with your child, and how were those arrangements going at that time? And there was, you know, there was so much turbulence around the team. How was that working out with your son during that time period?
Well, my Uncle George actually helped me out with that. You know, Ohio State couldn't do anything. They couldn't pay you. They couldn't give you any support, you know, but they was always knowing if I had to go home, they would know that I was gone and where I was at. So it wasn't about financial. It was about just helping me out. But my Uncle George wound up helping me, paying child support, you know, $25 a month. It was crazy at that age. And I just didn't understand it, but, you know, I had to figure it out, and my uncle helped me out a lot. But I had to get on the Greyhound sometimes to go see my uncle. I mean, go see my son. And, you know, the Greyhound stops like 10 times before you get to Louisville from Columbus. So it was rough, but it was all worth it, man. I looked at it, and, again, I just was thankful that I even got an opportunity, and that was all because I stayed focused. And everyone goes through problems. The University, the Ohio State University, we were struggling. Certain things were going on. I tore my ACL up. So, to me, everything happened for a reason. We all had to go through something to have to happen. And, you know, after we left, you know, the program took a little while to get back on top. But, you know, it's hard to keep a good program down, and I'm glad to see them back up.
Right. Now, in hindsight, I mean, you ended up transferring to Kentucky, but in hindsight, was there something necessary for you to learn at Ohio State in order for you to take the route that you took?
You say, was there something I learned?
Yeah, because I'm a firm believer that everything happens for a reason, and so sometimes we take pit stops, but and at the time we don't understand. But I'm a firm believer that sometimes during those pit stops, there's something that was there for you to learn that equipped you to be the man that you are today. And so
That was it. My whole life has been filled with adversity. From the time I was born in adversity. You know, everything that I've grown through has been about adversity. It's about building my character stronger for the next phase. Like, going through that process, I agree with you. Everything happens. Me being 11, struggling, helping me get basketball. Me having a child, keeping me from running to the streets, saving my life from being involved in other things. My child helped me stay focused. Going to Ohio State kept me from staying in Louisville. I've been able to become a man, see other things outside of what I've been seeing. So, therefore, I could graduate and broaden my mind. Then getting hurt my sophomore year and having a great season, said, hey, I need to refocus and go back home closer to my son. So, to me, everything about my life was basically trying to figure out the next step, and adversity was the thing that always pushed me to that.
Right. I have another one of your former teammates on the line. They're calling from an area code 614. Area code 614. Otis, are you there?
I'm here.
Otis, is there anything you wanted to say to Derek?
What up, D.A.?
What's up, brother?
Chilling, my dude, chilling. The only question I have, you know, I have a few, but the main question I have is, you and I have a lot in common, you know, growing up, single mom, and coming through the system. The one thing that I appreciate about you, or I want to ask you, you have always done the maximum with minimum.
Mm-hmm.
You've always done the maximum with minimum. And now, being out of the league, you're maximizing again. And what advice, because, you know, doing what I do, you doing what you do, what advice would you have for these young dudes who have it now, but it's not going to always be there. Basketball is not going to always be there. Football is not going to always be there. Shoot, entertainment is not going to always be there. What advice do you have for these young men out here who's getting the maximum now, but what happens when it minimizes?
Hmm.
Well, to me, it's all about whatever they put in their mind, whatever you put in your mind, I don't care what it is exactly what you get out of it. And that's what I tell these kids. No matter, I'm talking about from the video game to if you wanted to be a screenwriter, if you wanted to just be a person that just wrote all day, whatever you wanted to do, when you put it in your mind, that is exactly what comes out of your mind. So don't look at anyone else's issues or their success or whatnot. When you look at your life, if you wrote down the top five things you think about, that is exactly who you will become, whether it's good or bad. Your mind doesn't care about anything. Your mind is a muscle. And what's that mind, once you put it in your mind, what you want, that's what will come out. I've always wanted to better myself when I was a kid, when I played basketball, when I retired. Every single thing that I did, I said, I want to be better. And that's what happened. Like, now I'm maximizing my potential to share my story with people. And you see, I'm going on television shows. I write movie scripts. I'm able to connect with people because that's in my mind. When I go researching people, I say, who fits with Derek's system of thought process? I reach out, and they reach back. It's not a blueprint for it. It's just what you do. You know, that's your focus, like what you're doing now. Like, I'm so proud of you. You said this is what you're going to do, so eventually it's going to happen. It takes some people longer. It takes some people shorter. And that the whole fact that if you're trying, you put it in your mind, not nothing negative, all positive, it'll come out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, appreciate that, bro. Last question.
Yeah, I'll tell you a funny story, too. When I first stepped to Ohio State, everybody was telling me they saw Derek Anderson in the gym. I'm thinking, like, I ain't even played yet. And everybody said, man, he can jump. This guy's for real. I walk in, and everybody's looking at his oldest. people thought he was me, and they thought I was him. They think, like, I jump. I'm like, nah. They was all talking about, oh, that was funny. So ever since then, people were thinking we brothers.
Yeah, we got that a lot, too. We got that a lot.
That's funny. But that's funny saying Derek Anderson can jump, but that oldest dude, he's just all right.
No, they said he could jump too. He's a high jumper.
What was your other question, Otis?
Last question I have is us not having fathers, DA. I know what drives me to be a better father and this, things of that nature. What drives you? What drives you? Because you got to understand, you started young. So what gave you that fire? I know what gave you the fire, but we want to know what gave you that fire to be able to be a father at such a young age.
I think I just think I wanted better, you know. And when I got older, I started to realize, how many times have we ever seen our Heavenly Father God? Have you ever seen him in person? But you know he's there because he left a presence. He's put something in your mind. He's put something in your heart that you can never leave. You can never lose. Like when I see my son, I might not see him for a good 2 weeks or 3 weeks. But he knows I'm there because I put that love in his heart. I put that love in his mind. So no matter what or how far your father's gone, he's still there. And to me, I was like the same way. I was like, my son knows I'm at work. So even at 2 years old when I was working hard and trying to figure it out, you know, it was all about me making sure that I did what I could with the time I had. You know, the quality is always better than the quantity. You know, so, you know, I always looked at it that way. When I looked at him and I tell him, like, even now, it's better now. I get to see my two boys a lot more. But when I had the other two boys, it was like it wasn't enough time in a day, but I would call them. You have to text me. You have to call. Say I love you, and that left a presence. I got the greatest gift in the world with my 19-year-old son. He sends me a text and said, I'm so proud to be your son, not because of the athlete you are, but because of the man you are. I almost broke down in tears because I left an impression that I love him more than I am who's celebrity status. So I think if you just let your child know that you love him, man, that will last you no matter what.
Good stuff.
Wow, thank you, Otis, for your question and your comment. And if you think of something else, press 1, and we'll put you back through.
All right. Appreciate you. Thanks, Sil. D.A., you know I'm always proud of you, bro. Keep
always, bro. Talk to you soon, man. Love you, bro.
All right, my dude. Love you, too. Peace.
It's like we're all on a three-way phone conversation. So, Derek, so you ended up going from Ohio State and you transferred and went back home to Kentucky. Now, did Kentucky recruit you heavily? Like, what made you choose Ohio State over Kentucky initially?
Well, what's funny was I was going to the University of Louisville, and the University of Louisville's coach came to see me play and said he wanted me to come sign a scholarship. But I told him to come visit with me and my uncle because he had signed a bunch of kids, and I just wanted to know if he'd redshirt me. He didn't come, and the last day came, and Randy Ayers drove 4 hours down that same day. He called me, and he showed his loyalty. But the only reason I didn't go to Kentucky was Coach Pitino gave all his scholarships out, Roger Rose, Tony Dell, Walter McCarty. He had given all his scholarships, so I was like, well, I'm not coming to nobody's team in redshirt, and that's my whole point. I'm coming to play.
Right.
You know, I'm not sitting on nobody's bench, and that's why I told Coach Pitino, said, well, I want you to come play. You can play, but you're going to have to redshirt or you might have to get a walk-on. I'm like, no, I'm good. So as soon as I transferred from Ohio State, the first call I get was from Coach Pitino. He was like, okay, so we got a scholarship freed up. Are you coming? And I was like, okay, well, I'll come. And once that happened, you know, of course, you know the history behind it.
Right. So I'm assuming that you had to sit out for a year when you transferred to Kentucky. So talk about that timeout moment. What was it like being in your home state, practicing hard every day like everyone else, but not being able to compete on game day?
Well, it was very tough, but, you know, that's, again, adversity. You know, I was able to see something from a different light. What most people would look at as bad, I was like, I get to go see my son now when they're out of town. I spend time with him. I get to catch up on, you know, my grades. I get to lift weights. I get to do things that other players weren't able to do. And it was fun for me. You know, I just took my time, and I always just focused on getting better at everything that I did. So it was tough at first, but, you know, after a while I picked on, and you went by fast for me.
Right. Now, while at Kentucky, your team was projected to have a good season. You had dreams of going pro, and then in your senior year you tore your ACL. Talk about that timeout moment.
Well, I had no more eligibility. I was a fifth-year senior. I was done. I couldn't play anymore, and I only played 18 games, but I was projected number 1 or 2 pick in a draft. So my thought was, okay, I've been through this before. I can rebound, so it wasn't mental. It was all about physical. And once I figured I could get myself mentally prepared to get back for the draft, I immediately went to work. I went in the swimming pool at 6 in the morning, 8 o'clock class, 11 o'clock eat. Class, then I came back at 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the working out, and then at 6 o'clock p.m. I went back to the swimming pool. I had a schedule that I was on that I said, I am not going to let this knee bother me, and I'm going to get to the NBA. And it wasn't so much the NBA. I was going to say I was really trying to graduate, but I said, I'm not going to let this stop me from whatever's happened, because I had my education I was going to get regardless. And that's what I told my son. I was like, no matter what basketball does, you're not going to tell me I'm not supposed to graduate, I'm not supposed to be smarter than what my situation is. So I focused on finishing school and doing everything I could. But it was another adversity, because most people was like, well, man, you got the worst luck. But to me, it's like, I got the best luck. I get to see life for what it really is. You know, I don't believe in that fantasy. Like, you go through life, then your entire life, like, okay, you know, it's easy. I found out that life is hard early. So now that I'm older, and as an adult, I get to see life just is a bunch of trials. You know, I've done everything right, never drank, never smoked, never done anything wrong, never robbed, never sold drugs, never did anything, but you still get negative people to say negative things about you, and there's nothing you can do. But you have to live your life. So I just do that, and I don't worry about anything else except being right for God and right for my family and friends and my children. And that's all you can do. So I faced that adversity all those years early just to prepare me for a better life now. Now I don't hear none of that stupid and negative stuff, and I smile and I sleep good at night, and it's only because I went through so much so early.
Right. Now, what did that timeout moment teach you? Because this is your second ACL tear, and statistics say that it's hard to bounce back from an ACL tear in surgery. And so this is not your first, but your second one. So, you know, going through that and rehabbing, what did that teach you?
Again, it taught me the positivity of your mind. Again, I said, I'm not going to let this defeat me. So you look at some of these guys who take forever to come back, or they might say, I don't know, I feel I got to wear a knee brace. You know, that's a mental thought process, because once your body heals, there's nothing it can't do. You know, I had I wound up dunking on more people once I had my second ACL than I did when I didn't. And it was all mental for me. You know what I mean? I mean, you can look at my highlights. I played 11 years in the league. I probably dunked on at least 40, 50 people throughout that time. And I'm talking about, like, dunked on people, not just regular dunks, like, you know, dunked on people. And it was all because it was a mental process. Yeah, it was just mental. So, to me, I just think it's all – that's how life is, man. You know, you can have any kind of, you know, adversity or injuries or a handicap where you're paralyzed or whatnot, but – it's a mental process that you have to develop, and I, like I said, I was able to do that, and that's how I survived. How many people got drafted in the lottery with two ACLs? Me and Sidney Moncrief is the only two dudes that ever do it.
Right.
And he only had one ACL. He didn't have two.
It's basically unheard of. What? Now, this is my question. Did it happen in the beginning of your senior year or towards the end, like the second half of your
senior year? I was in the middle.
Year?
It was in the middle. It was 18 games, and then we had another 19 games left.
So
it was in
the
middle of the season.
So the team won a national championship that year. Did you get to play in that game?
No, we won a championship my junior year, the year 1996. We wound up winning a championship.
Oh, okay.
Then my senior year, we went to the Final Four, and I got to shoot two free throws and hit two free throws in front of 30,000 people I hadn't played in 2.5 months. So it was amazing.
That's the part I was trying to figure out. So your senior year – you get injured in the middle of the year. You shoot two free throws, at the end of the season, and you get drafted. I think you went 13th pick to Cleveland Cavaliers. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
So you got to know, Derek, at this time that God's hand is on you, because most people wouldn't touch you with a 10-foot pole. You had two knee surgeries, and you didn't even play your senior year. So you're rusty, and you're going into the NBA where the talent is, you know, kicked up three times higher than what you experienced in college. Like, that is unheard of, but it happened for you.
It's not unheard of. It just hadn't been written yet, and that's what I do. I write my own life story. I don't let someone else write.
Wow. Now, after all you had went through with, just things not working out at Ohio State, and you having to come back home to Kentucky, you sat out a year, you tear your ACL in your senior year, not really knowing for sure you knew who you were and what you were capable of, but the teams in the NBA, they didn't really know, so you didn't know what was going on in their minds. How did it feel when your name was finally called in the draft? Talk to our listeners about just kind of what was going through your mind at that time.
You know what? It was like a sigh of relief. I finally got to breathe. And it was like, it wasn't so much proving people sold it wrong. It was like saying that what I did was say, I'm going to make it, and I actually made it. So I was like, you know how you like, it's not, I guess not self-doubt, but you talking so much. And then when it happened, it was like, man, now I can just lay back, sit down, and go back to work. Because I really was, I wasn't stressed, but I was just so excited because I got so much stuff going on, and, you know, then Michael Jordan calls me and tells me he wants me to wear a shoe line. I got my own personal shoe, Michael Jordan. I got a Sprite deal, and I don't even drink soda. And I'm just like, man, I'm going through all these things. And then when I got drafted, it was like, I'm good now. You know, I can just thank God and pray and just keep doing what I've been doing, because that's all it was. I knew God had his hand on me. I would have never made it that far, but it's still – God has his hand on everyone, but when you walk away from him, he lets things happen to you. And he never let nothing happen to me to where it affected my life. It affected the decisions I had to make, but it never affected my life to where it stopped my life, and I was thankful for that.
I think a lot of people, they don't understand the anxiety and the pressure that come with draft day. And sometimes your agent can fill you in on exactly where you're probably going to go in the draft. And sometimes teams don't know until the picks, you know, until the picks before them happen, and then everything changes. You know, like let's say somebody decides to pick one player, then all the teams behind them, it's like a domino effect. They start switching up who they're going to pick. So how did it happen for you? Were you thinking that you would go higher and you were disappointed when you were called 13th, or did you know you were going to go around that pick and you were just excited to hear your name called?
Well, I had heard a bunch of things. People said I was supposed to be the number two pick behind Tim Duncan, and they said I might be the number one pick because David Robinson was coming back, and they said we need a scoring guard and to go with David Robinson. Then they said, well, I'm out. Now let's take Tim Duncan because he's going to be our future. And there was a whole bunch of stuff I heard, but I was supposed to go number two. Boston was supposed to, Coach Patino went there. He was supposed to draft me, but the word was Red Harper. I didn't want to touch me, like you said, because I had two ACLs. So he told Ron Mercer. And I heard a whole bunch of stories. And they said I was supposed to go to Sacramento, but I told him I didn't want to go to Sacramento. And then I heard that Cleveland was going to get me a 13th, and I'm like, well, let's go there. Sean Kemp was coming. I was like, yeah, I'd rather go play with him. So it was anxiety, but I knew I was getting drafted after a while. I went to all these camps. I showed them I was dominating. I'm hearing all these top players, and I'm just destroying them in these workouts. So I knew I was good. I just wanted to make sure I stayed healthy.
Right. Now, for somebody coming off of an ACL tear, you started out pretty good in the NBA. You were named to the All-Rookie Second Team. And overall, when I looked at it, you had a pretty good career in the NBA. You averaged 12 points, 3 rebounds, over 3 assists. You won a championship with the Heat. Very few people can say they've been a part of an NCAA championship and an NBA championship. Did you ever stop and say, wow, I can't believe this is actually happening to me? Or did you feel as though you were due for something good to happen to you?
Well, was it? I'm not doing anything. I'm giving out what I deserve from what I work hard for. Like, no one's supposed to have anything except what you work for. You know, God mm-hmm. doesn't want any soft people just to come to heaven. He wants you to go through something so he knows you're strong enough to be in the kingdom of heaven. So to me, I've always felt like the strongest battles are given to the strongest, you know, the toughest battles are given to the toughest people. And I think we all go through tough times, so we know where we need to go. So it's not a hard part for me, and to be thankful that I won championship after championship. I am definitely very blessed. But again, I sacrificed to do that because everyone, Michael Jordan, everybody said, they said, why don't you shoot more? I averaged like 8 to 12, 10 shots my entire career. If I would have shot like Kobe and had 20 points, and you see when I did everything like these superstars did, but I always wanted to win and make my teammates better. When I was in the Junior Olympics, I averaged 28 points because I knew I could fill it up. But I went back to Ohio State. I wanted to pass the ball with Greg and Otis and them guys. I could have came out and shot all the balls and had every right to. But that's not how I believed in playing and making a better teammate of my team. So I've always mm-hmm. shared the ball. I could have easy shot. I could have scored 5 points a quarter every day in the NBA. Easy for me. I'm a good jump shooter, dribble, whatever, but I wanted to win. That's my sacrifice because I didn't get the Hall of Fame, but I got the respect of my teammates, which lasts a lot longer than the Hall of Fame accolade. Now I can call my friends and have good conversations. We go meet each other, have family events. You know, these are the things that I enjoy as a person, and that's why I'm happy to say I had a great career because of that.
Yeah, that question was a heart check to see how humble you were. But, you know, some people feel like it's about time something good happened to me, you know, and other people are like, wow, you know, like when I won a national championship, I can remember I felt like I'm just a kid from Steubenville, Ohio. Like, I can't believe this happened to me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
How did I get here? I was just overwhelmed knowing where I came from, you know.
All right.
So,
but you was thankful. So long as you're thankful,
I was incredibly thankful and humbled, you know. I want to ask you this. With the exception of maybe Portland, you played with teams for 1 to 3 years and then was traded or moved to the next team. Now, some guys want stability of not having to bounce their families around, and others understand that it's the nature of the profession. Did it ever bother you that you weren't able to really be stationary and plant roots somewhere? Did that ever bother you?
What's funny was I only got traded once. When I was with Cleveland, they wasn't paying me $60 million, so they said, we got to release you because we can't pay you. The year I went to play with Clippers, I signed a one-year deal because it was my last-year deal. I didn't come back to them. San Antonio, I signed a one-year deal, and I told them I'm not coming back, so they did a sign-and-trade. And a lot of the people mm-hmm. who don't know basketball, they have no idea what that is. That means you can get something for that player instead of paying because mm-hmm. you're not going to be able to pay him what he wants. I go to Portland, we get released because everyone was, the whole team got dismantled. So I got the waiver because they was nice to me. They said, hey, we're gonna give you the amnesty because you're the good guy. People thinking it's a bad thing, but like Allen Houston got it and all these other, but I got it because they said we want to pay you so you can go somewhere else and still get paid by us and you get another check. So that wasn't a bad. Mm-hmm. I left on good terms. I go to Houston Rockets and I sign a year. The whole team gets Yao gets hurt, Tracy gets hurt. Jeff Van Gundy comes and say, I know your situation. I know you're on a 1-year contract. You know, if you're not happy here, let me know. I said, no, I would rather be traded to a team who's going to at least go to a contender. He put me out of the West and said, I'm going to send you to Miami because Pat Riley been wanting you anyway. So he sent me to Pat Riley. After we won a championship, I retired. People thinking they traded me or let me or released me. I'm like, well, if they released me, why would they release me? And I was only making $1 million. And he said, no, he wants to retire. I retired. So after a few months, Michael Jordan called me and said, I want you to come help Charlotte Bobcats. So I went to help Michael. So I was only traded once, but no one really knows the NBA. They thinking I've been traded a lot. And that's the key. Like, I haven't been traded but one time. The rest of it is business. So.
Right. So one way or another, you moved from team to team every 2 to 3 years or so. So did it ever bother you that, you know, you weren't able to kind of stay in one place and be stationary? You know, you've got a son at this time. Did that part ever bother you about it?
No, that's fun. I was never married, never been married. I didn't have a girlfriend, single. I was just with my son, and that was it. Like, I didn't have any worry in the world. I wasn't like I had a family to move around. You know, if me and my son was to go somewhere, it was an experience. Like, for me to go to Cleveland, then go to California, that was great. Then to go to San Antonio was great. Then I stayed 5 years in Portland. And then I had a few months in Houston and then Miami, and that was it. And then Charlotte was right up the street from Atlanta where I lived. So, it wasn't bad for me. I didn't have a family uprooting. But it was a great experience. I loved it. I loved to see new things. So, to me, it was awesome.
Right. Yeah, and I think, you know, to be in that profession, you got to have that kind of mentality about it. But there are people who struggle with that. You know, they just kind of want to be planted. They don't want to bounce from place to place, especially after you've done it for so long. So I just wonder, you know, what was your take on that? Now, Derek, sometimes a player has to find the right fit in terms of a team that needs them, a system where their style of play can flourish, a coach that believes in them and gives them the green light to be themselves. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that place for you was Portland. And I could be biased because that was the one place where our paths crossed. I was playing for Portland Fire, so I got to watch a lot of your games, and my team was owned by the Trailblazers. And I felt like you were comfortable there. I felt like, you know, you were finally playing, you know, like yourself. I mean, it's almost like you could be yourself, you know. You had the green light to kind of play your game. Did you feel like, or was there a particular place where you felt comfortable with the city, the arena, the coach, the team?
Was that Portland or was that another team? Everywhere I played, I had a great time because I allowed it. Only the Clippers, because they weren't paying anybody to come back, I knew I wasn't going to come. Everywhere else, I had a great time, city, fans, players. But the only problem I had was the other teammates around me who didn't want to do the right thing. Remember in Portland? I never got in trouble, not one single time. But everybody else was getting in trouble, and it broke the team up. They called us the Jailblazers. But who was the only person that never got in trouble was me. And I'm telling you, it's not me. It was always the situations I was in. You know, I had to go bail guys out of jail. I had to pick guys up to bring them to the arena. You know, I was doing things as a good teammate and a good person would do. But Portland was a great place. But I think San Antonio was even a better place because of the people. I love warm weather. My teammates were great. I mean, Tim was the most unselfish.
San Antonio is a great organization.
Yeah.
From the top all the way down.
Well, I wouldn't say the top because he told me he wasn't going to pay me because of my injury, and it was because of the guy took me out of the area. It wasn't like I got hurt. I played all 82 games, and then a guy, Juwan Howard, takes me out of there, and the general manager says he didn't want to pay me. And that's when he tried to put out what Derek doesn't want to wait till we sign Tim Duncan. I'm like, the signing date was a month ago. Everybody else is signing. Why are you waiting to pay me? And I'm in my fifth year, and David, and you say you're going to pay David. Pay David. What is he waiting on? And then pay me. I don't mind waiting. But they trying to make me wait to lowball me because it was like three other two guards out there that they were trying to get. So now he's trying to play the game, and then he throws it out that I was the one that was not waiting. So I think Portland was a great place for me, but San Antonio was a great place too. Those are two of the best places I felt comfortable with playing.
Okay, so let's rewind to something you said. You said that you like Portland, but it was the people around you. So why do you feel like you were in that situation a lot, where you weren't getting in trouble, but there was trouble all around you? Why do you think there's a reason for that?
It could have been for me to help them out, which I did. I was always leading Bible study. I did everything. You know, it could have been that, but that's the process of it. And, you know, I take it for what it is. I was there to help people out, but again, I knew I wasn't going to be happy because of the situations that were around me. So I let those things not deter me from what I had to do, come to work and help these guys out. But it was more off-the-court stuff that I was trying to help them out with mentally. So I think that could have been it. It was my job to try to help those guys out. And I helped a couple of them out, and that's all I could do.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking that more importantly than you helping out on the court with your basketball skills, it could have been that you were strategically placed there in the middle of all that, like you were, you know, most times in college, and it was no different in the pros, so that you could do the Bible studies and you could be kind of like that pillar, because you have been through so much early in life that you were stronger than most guys, you know, and maybe they needed that at that time. It's interesting how God works things out that way.
Absolutely.
Now, usually, Derek, when a player starts to move from team to team, it's signs that their career is about to end. Were there any signs for you as your career came to an end? Did you see the signs and did you know it was coming to an end, or were you caught off guard?
No, I never felt that way. I was still playing. When I retired, the first time I had a bunch of calls, and I didn't want to come back. And after I retired from the Bobcats, I had a bunch of calls. So I never felt like my career was over, because one thing a coach told me, he said, so long as the way you think the game, you could play for a long time, because I could outthink you. You know, I didn't have to jump and dunk on you. I could outthink you. I could play. I could still shoot. So I never felt that coming. And, like, again, I wasn't being traded. I was asking to leave. So I see some guys, like Jimmy Jackson, was traded all the time, but he could play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't think the guys think that their career is coming to an end until people don't play you at all. That's when you need to worry. Like, I started my game. My last game I played in the NBA, I had 17 points. The next time I didn't play, I was gone. I retired. So, to me, it never hit me like that.
So you ended your career on your own terms.
Yes, indeed.
And I'm a firm believer that transitions are very important. So I think however you end something is what you tend to remember for the rest of your life. Like, you could have had a great career, but if it got snatched away from you, you got cut or you got injured, that tends to be what you focus on for the rest of your life instead of remembering the happy times. And so Michael Jordan once told me that, I asked him, how do you know when it's time to retire? I worked his camp at Elmhurst College, and he said, your body and your heart will let you know when it's time. And so, and when it was my time to retire, I knew it. My body and my heart just told me I had 2 more years left on my contract, and I walked away on my own terms. And I have peace of mind in terms of my playing career. Like, I don't miss it. I left when it was time. I coached, and I wasn't trying to dream through my players, you know. So I'm happy that you stopped playing when you were ready to stop playing.
That's the thing.
Now,
can't miss anything you love.
Why did you make a decision to stop playing? Was it your body and your heart that let you know?
Yeah, I lost the love for it. It became a business and it's no more fun. It was all about business. They playing guys who weren't that good. You're getting guys on the team who was crying. You're getting paid $1 million to play basketball. And you see a grown man crying and complaining. I said, yeah, this is not the life I want to be in anymore. I want to go do something else with it. That's what I did. I can't stand to see people take advantage of a situation. And I always thought back to my childhood, like, man, I was starving and been busted up, and you weren't about this? Nah, you need to embrace this and enjoy it and overcome everything and make it work for you. So I knew it was time for me to go.
Now, were you able to prepare for the day that you walked away from the NBA in terms of
Absolutely.
Business and financially?
I started my business when I was my rookie year, and then the lockout year, started my foundation to help abuse and battered women and children. And also in that year, I was getting my relationship with my mother back. I went and found her after all them years, and it was like, you know what? I want to build a relationship with my family and my mother and just try to bond with that, and that's what made me feel more comfortable than anything. And I've never wanted to be famous. I just wanted to be effective in life.
Wow. So, Derek, I talked a little bit earlier about Beyond the Bounce Conference, and it was a program just in place to help players with their transition from basketball to the next phase of life. Talk about your transition out of the NBA, like, the minute you walked away and said, you know, y'all can have this, I'm not going to do this anymore. Talk about that transition and realizing that, okay, I don't have to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning and rehab or train or do anything. You know, I'm just Derek Anderson. I'm going to the grocery store to get some groceries like everybody else. Talk about that transition.
Well, it wasn't tough because I would already prepare for that. Again, I had planned for that moment. Like, most guys don't know what happens. They don't plan for it. Like, they say, I'm going to play this year, I'm going to play this year, I'm going to play this year. And then when they don't get picked up, they don't know what to do. Like, I had already made a decision. Like, this was it for me. Like, you know, I was done. Like, I was really done that 10th year, but the 11th year I came one back just because of Michael Jordan. And I wanted to help those young guys out. So after that, I knew I was done. So, you know, I had a plan. If you don't have a plan, you will be lost. And, you know, that program you're talking about, like, a lot of NBA guys and a lot of the NBA, they say they care, but they only care about a select few. You know, when you do these programs, you can find all NBA guys that you know on Twitter, on social media, so they can't say they can't find us. And I think some of these programs are good, but they're good for certain people. And I think that's the issue that I was having when we last spoke. It's like, for us to help each other and to build each other, we need to find each other and build it as a team. I've started this company called the Champion Group. Like, why wouldn't all the NBA guys work together? Because you think about it, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett work together, and they're the two richest dudes in the world. They don't need each other's money, but they want the knowledge. You can't get two top NBA guys to work together in business for nothing in your life because they're too egotistical or they got too much of a I-want-to-be-the-man type attitude. And that's the issue. And then all of a sudden, when they don't have the money or the fame, now they come looking for help and they go back to the NBA trying to get help. And
well,
you know, I think some of these programs
that
should be good.
Well, I will tell you that I was in attendance at the conference, and I didn't see any of that. I mean, people were really trying to help each other. It's for everybody. Now, whether they got the news out and across to everyone in terms of invitation, I don't know. But it seemed like a good core group that came together. They were really trying to help each other. I think it's a great program for you to just come and maybe talk to some of the other guys because there is a lot of pride and, you know, they've been stars their whole lives, and, you know, some of them went through a depression when it was over. And, you know, like, I played for 23 years. That's a long time to love something and walk away from it. That's like a divorce almost, you know. So people go through very traumatic things. And so it does people good to hear your story and look, these are some of the things that I had to do, and this is what helped me. And, you know, they weren't preparing like you were for the end. But, you know, I think that will be a way for you to kind of reach out to that organization and they reach out to your organization and everybody help each other.
Yeah,
now,
it's a select few. I'll reach out to them, but, you know, that's all in the past. I mean, I'm willing to help anybody, but, you know, when you go through separations like that, like, I've never been separated from anything that I felt like that. You know, I've never put myself in that situation where I couldn't get myself out of it. So I don't know how people go through it, and I can't speak on how guys struggle like that. You know, some people have been babied or kissed up to and had basketball their entire lives, but I guess no one taught them, you know, life is not all about basketball. And the people have given them that threshold to say, hey, you're the man for so long. Now they actually believe that. And I've never had that thought process. I've always believed this was just a job to help me out of my situation, and my future was to basically be a good person. That's why I never changed who I was.
Mm-hmm. Now, I saw where you tweeted, once you embrace your journey, the world and worldly people will move out of your way. What did you mean by that, and how have you embraced your journey?
Once I've accepted I have a life to live on my own, I don't have to follow to be like someone or to act like someone or to make you feel like you like me, I could able to be who I am, and I enjoyed it. the world gets out of your way. People accepted me now. They said, Derek doesn't drink, he doesn't smoke, so he's not going to a club, he's not doing this and that. So now they're like, oh, wow, well, this is who he is. They stop messing with you. They stop begging you to do something. They stop trying to tempt you to do stuff. They just accept you for who you are. That way they get out of your way. The world does the same thing. You know, of course it throws some rinks at you, but once you ignore, you know, the ignorance of it, you don't become ignorant and start arguing with people. Like, I've learned to say, you know, I'm not going to argue with this person. They don't have a clue what they're talking about. You know, then all of a sudden the argument stops. You have one person can't argue with you if you don't argue back. It's just a simple form that I've learned. I've learned to just, you know, embrace who I am, accept who I am. I'm going to be this way the rest of my life, and all I can do is get better. I can learn. Even I'm 40 years old, I can learn a lot. I still have that in my body, mind, that I'm going to learn and get better as a person. So once you accept your journey, you will be able to live a life that you will not believe how good it is.
Right. And I think that's the part people should struggle with, is accepting their journey. Derek, you wrote a book, and for those, there's some people who are just kind of chiming in. I'm sitting here with Derek Anderson, who is a former NBA player and now an author and entrepreneur. We're going to get into some of the projects that he's doing now. But, Derek, let's talk about your book, Stamina. The title is Stamina, and I guess the subtitle is Don't Run Out of Breath Before You Win. And it was endorsed by Michael Jordan on the back of the book. It says, I believe in Derek, not just for his talent, but because of his positive attitude when facing adversity. He still has that drive after basketball, and that's why he's a champion, Michael Jordan. Derek, what message did you, the title says it all, but when people really dive into the book, what was your hope that people would walk away from when they read this book? Like, what was your prayer for the book when you released it?
That it would heal people. And heal people not just from emotional scars, but a mental scar. Our society has been brainwashing us for so many years to think negativity is exciting. They got the news now. When we grew up, news was talking about good stuff, fun stuff. A very sudden, you might see us a bad thing. We've been brainwashed so bad that we think negative stuff is okay now. I don't judge anyone. The girl, Nicki Minaj's name, states that it's okay to say her name all day long to young girls. What message are you sending? You know, I mean, we've accepted negativity through society, and it's brainwashing us. And I wanted people to say, wake up. You know, even life struggles, and you're never too old to forgive someone. You're never too hurt to love somebody. You know, and I think it's about loving and forgiving. I got with my mother for the first time in 28 years. We had Christmas dinner last year. You know, after all the struggles I was going back and forth, whatever, the rehab, and I finally got to have Christmas dinner with my mother last year. And once I did that, I was just like, wow, this is amazing. And I was really thankful. So I wrote it and just said, hey, people, this is what we need to do. Don't negotiate with your kids. Tell them, say yes, sir, and yes, ma'am. So when you send them to school, you know what you're sending to school. Don't sit there and say, oh, the teachers are bad. No, you got taking care of your child at home, and you send them to the schools, and now each one of those school kids are learning from each other, and they're all bad or misfortune or whatever's happening. That's the issue we're having. So I gave a lot of nuggets about a lot of things, but it's basically just about life. I wanted to see people to see what I've gone through and what I've learned as a person, and I'm still growing. You know, I understand I'm not perfect by any means, but I've accepted my flaws, and I've accepted how to change them. I don't just say, yeah, this is me, I'm going to do this, this, and that, and I'm going to be, no. I've accepted I need to grow. That's what I've accepted. So my book and hope, I just pray that everyone gets a better life now from reading and helping their kids become better people.
Right. And so, Derek, tell people how they can get your book.
You can go to DerekAndersonWorks.com, and it's on Amazon as well. You can get it on Kindle. We got it in Mandarin language. You know, Spanish, we're going to have it in all so everyone can read it. Because it's not a race book. It's about a life book. Every person in the world can read this. So you go to those sites and you can get it. And my Derek Anderson works, I sign all of them. The ones come from my thing, I sign them so they get them. And I'm doing speaking events and whatnot now.
Now, how did you have a ghostwriter, a writer to sit down with you and write this, or you wrote it yourself?
Nope, I wrote it all myself. I wrote 15 movie scripts. I wrote 4 books. It's my first one. I've done everything. All I had was an editor help me out. That's it. Never had anybody write anything. I've learned how to do it.
So Stamina is turning into a movie.
Yep. Documentary for school systems and the movie.
Wow.
Teaches them every decision we make as a consequence.
I saw a Stamina magazine on your Twitter page. Is it a magazine too?
Yep.
Okay.
We're going to have a magazine
covering
all
forms of media.
Yep. Nothing stronger than it's very few words in the world that's going to affect everyone. Love is one of them, and I think stamina is another one too. If you got stamina, you can win in anything.
Mhm. Now, Derek, I want to give you a chance to clear up something because as I was preparing for this interview, you know, I kind of looked up some stuff on Wikipedia and I got on Google, and there's something out there that is negative about you. And with Google, and I go through this too, my whole life is on Google. So if there's something that's negative or somebody painted a mustache on my picture, and it's on there forever, like I can't get it taken off. So I want to give you a chance to tell your story. I mean, Google has their story, but there's an article that talks about how there was a drug transaction that happened and somebody said that you were the money man behind it. And I'm sure you are kind of aware of what I'm alluding to. I want to give you an opportunity to tell your story.
We're suing the city for that. It was just the city people who was pissed at me for helping out my community. The guy said I never met him. The guy was a guy who had killed like three people, set him on fire, and we went to sue him, and this isn't that. But Google loved to put stupid stuff out. Like nobody in the city believes you have people calling in. Why would you guys put that out about him? He's not done it. He was poor in the projects. He never sold drugs. Why would he make money and all of a sudden sell drugs? You people are terrible, so I had the whole city supporting me, and it's just what people do. Like I said, it's negative, ignorant people in the world all over, and that was a message for me to try to help these, because I was helping the whole community out. I gave $2 million of my own money, cleaned it up, built up, provided over 400 jobs, and what happened was I was my family, some of my family members who did sell drugs were in jail or dead. They wanted to link into that. I'm just like, well, you knew they was doing that before I made it to the NBA. Now all of a sudden, this is the situation? But it was just a city of people, some jealous, I don't even know if it's racist or not, but it was some jealous people who just wanted to put that out, and now we sued the city, and now it's a big thing. They're going to have to pay me for defamation of character and this and that, but it's out there. You know, and I've had people schools and ask me about it, and I had to explain to them the same situation, but my character never flawed. Like, people believe in my character because my entire life has been positive. So now you do this, you still couldn't do anything. And it was the funniest thing. When all of a sudden they said, well, the guy never said he met you, so why would you put that out if he never met me? How's he going to just name something like that? You said that. You wanted him to say that, and so you can let a convicted killer get out of jail and tarnish my name. Is that what you guys just did? So we went through a whole big thing about it, but it's the ignorance of people, and you have to realize this world right now, freedom of speech has gone bad. You got people bullying people. You got people disrespecting, you know, the people who really like the president. Like, you couldn't talk to no one in a different country that type of way. This world, again, is built on negative society thoughts, and that's our problem we have.
I just rode from Florida to Connecticut today, and I saw a billboard that said, Stop Obama. And I thought to myself, when could you ever post a billboard that says stop the president? Like, this is the president of the United States.
Exactly.
And there's a billboard that says stop Obama. Regardless of how you feel about it, like, who posted that billboard? You know, who paid for it and who allowed it to happen?
That's like me just going out right now saying something about your site, and I can just post something about your site up on a billboard just to dog you out just so you don't win. Society is allowing that stupid stuff to go, and they wonder what happened. We're going to be a third world country because we're all going to fight each other one day, and we're going to be living in the bottom of the pit one day because society is doing it to us. If you're not a part of the change, then you shouldn't complain, and I'm trying to change it.
Well, the article did say that you were never convicted of anything, and it was, you could tell that it was an article that was just out there, and I wanted you to have a chance to give your side of the story. Now, we talked about how Michael Jordan endorsed your book. He also backs your water company. You have a company called Victory H2O Water. Talk to us a little bit about that and why you chose to get into that particular line of business as opposed to any others that you could have chosen.
Well, I have a lot of businesses, and I just whatever comes to my mind that I enjoy, I do. And so I just enjoy that. So I have no purpose about it. I didn't really think twice about it. All I did was, you know what, this is what I like to do. I want to give people the thought process that you need water in your body. And I came up with it. You know, I'm trying to work a deal with Michael Jordan, and hopefully it works. But, you know, he's just always been a good friend, and I always want to get his input.
Right. So, Derek, I want to thank you for taking time out to be with us tonight. You definitely have an interesting story. I would encourage everyone to go out and get the book, Stamina. It's in stores. You can get it on Amazon. Derek, tell our listeners how they can keep up with you through social media and keep up with your events and where you're going to be for book signings and stuff like that.
You can go to DerekAndersonWorks.com, and you'll see everything. And you have the Derek Anderson, Derek L. Anderson on Instagram, and Twitter is Derek L. Anderson, and Facebook. You can hit me up on all that, and you'll see everything that I got going on, and everybody can help me out and support whatever we're doing. We're going to build a big foundation in this place for everything, and it should be fun, man. Just want to get as many people who care about life and having fun to join on with me. I appreciate you,
right. So, Derek, I'm going to close the show with a quote that you said. You said you had a lot of tweetable moments. I'm going to tweet some stuff as soon as we hang up. But you said that exactly what you put in your mind is exactly what you get. So if you feed your mind with video games and videos, that's what you're going to get out. If you feed your mind with your goals and dreams and focus on that and work towards that, that's what you'll get also. So I want to encourage
100%
people
100% of the time.
Right. I want to encourage people to keep dreaming and be careful what you feed your mind in terms of music and movies and even conversation, what you're speaking, you know, with your friends, because words are powerful and your mind is powerful. So I want to thank you, Derek, for just not giving up throughout all the adversity that you have. You set an example for people that, you know, good things can happen if you keep doing everything the right way and you stay true to who you are and stay true to what you know. You know, it's an encouragement to all of us to know that you went from an abandoned building to winning, you know, NBA championships and gold medals and NCAA championships because you didn't quit. You didn't let that stop you. You didn't let the naysayers discourage you. So thank you for that. This is my time. You're listening to Time Out with Sylvia Crowley. I encourage you to tune in next week. You can find out, you know, who's going to be on the show on our Facebook page and like our Time Out Facebook page. I need like 10 more likes, so get on the page, like our page, and I'll see you same time, same place next week. Have a blessed day.
Tell me what you want, tell me what you see, where you want to go, what you want to be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice. Wait, hold up, slow down, devil need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them, then after you do, go and talk to him. Great, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight, take your time today, teach you something right.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends, Twitter, you the trend, him a Bentley Benz, but you moving kinda fast. Keep sweating, you gotta make it last. Live every day like it's your last, but don't forget to have a blast.